This program is a presentation of UCTV for educational and non-commercial use only.
This is the second time I've been asked to introduce Richard Rodriguez to a UCSB audience. It's my great pleasure to do so again. In my first introduction back in 1995, I apologized to Richard for the fact that it took us 13 years to have him on our campus from the publication of his first and highly acclaimed book, Hunger of Memory. I am glad that it didn't take as long for this visit. In fact, Richard has fortunately become a recent visitor to our campus, having been here last spring for a panel on the media and politics. I have a reputation of giving lengthy introductions to the extent that sometimes the audience begins to get the impression that I am the main speaker. I am Richard Rodriguez. I promise not to do that today, I hope. Actually, Richard and I have various things in common. We were both born the same year, and both of us went through disciplined Catholic school education. I have no problems identifying with Richard Rodriguez. Simply put, Richard Rodriguez is one of the major critics of American society today. I may not always agree with him, but I cannot deny that he has made me think and to engage with his views. At the same time, I know of no other writer that has forced me to say to myself, yes, that's exactly right, or to say, I hadn't quite thought of it that way. Here is a mind, Richard Rodriguez's, constantly in motion, constantly seeing what the rest of us don't, or what is worse, don't want to see. Richard Rodriguez, as I said 7 years ago, cannot be pigeonholed as some of his detractors would like to do. Like ourselves, Richard is not just one person, but many, and as complicated and as messy as the rest of us. He is the embodiment of becoming and being brown, as he will explain this afternoon. Richard Rodriguez, a native of Sacramento who lives in San Francisco, received his BA at Stanford and his PhD in English Renaissance Literature from UC Berkeley. He is the author of his highly praised and widely read autobiography entitled Hunger of Memory, The Education of Richard Rodriguez, published in 1982, and Days of Obligation, An Argument with My Mexican Father, published in 1992, and a Pulitzer Prize finalist, and the last of a trilogy, his just published book, Brown, The Last Discovery of America, published in 2002. As a journalist, Richard is affiliated with the Pacific News Service, which distributes his many and provocative newspaper essays. Many of us have read these essays in the Los Angeles Times, where he also serves as a contributing editor. The very Sunday after 9/11, the Times turned to Richard to put that tragic day in perspective in the lead essay in the Times Sunday opinion section. He is also a contributing editor for Harper's Magazine. Some of you perhaps know Richard best in his role as a television essayist on the Lear NewsHour on public television. His insightful and thoughtful essays in this venue have earned him a richly deserved Peabody Award and an Emmy. In 1992, Richard Rodriguez further was honored by receiving the Frankel Medal, the highest honor awarded by the National Endowment for the Humanities. Richard, I tried to wear that black suit, but this is as close to it as possible. His lecture today is Brown, An Erotic History of the Americas. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming back to UCSB Richard Rodriguez.
Sorry that I have to scare you. We'll get together.
Thank you, Mario, very much. Whenever I come to UCSB, it's always Mario that gets forced into the role of being my greeter, and there he was wondering where I was just 10 minutes ago. I was on the damn freeway trying to get here, and I'm a bit breathless. So let me catch myself and tell you that I've come to talk to you about a very odd color indeed. I've come to talk to you about the color brown. If you spend as many years as I have thinking about a color, about 7 years ago I began to think that maybe I was having a nervous breakdown because I would get up from my writing and it occurred to me that everything around me was turning brown. The ceiling in my kitchen, which I hadn't cleaned for some time, was looking pretty brown to me. My coffee was brown. My legs were brown. The UPS man is brown. He comes at 10 o'clock every morning. I don't know what he is, actually. I think he's African, Samoan, or maybe Samoan, Filipino. Anyway, he's brown. And it occurred to me maybe about 7 years ago that I would not finish this book, that there was a madness coming over me. Because as I began to think about history, brown was everywhere. Eve takes a bite of the apple, and she offers it to Adam. And they take their bite, and they put the apple away. They cast it off, having sinned, and the apple turns brown. Everything browns in time. Every one of us browned in time. The ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, which the Pope, in a little blasphemy, decided to clean with the assistance of a Japanese corporation. The Japanese are probably the last race in the world who believe in water and cleansing. And they thought if they put enough water on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, they would be able to take away the brown from the great vision, Michelangelo's vision of the creation and judgment, the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. And it was a little blasphemy on the part of the Polish Pope to think that you could see the creation and the end of time without brown, because brown is in some way the color of time. And those little children playing behind Monticello at Thomas Jefferson's house, those little brown children, we never knew exactly whose children they were, but they were brown. And Hispanics, of course, everyone knows Hispanics are brown. Even though many of us come from other races, many of us come from races all over the world, and blonde Hispanics are always told by other Americans, you don't look Hispanic, by which I think Americans mean you don't look brown. What interests me about brown is that it is a very, very impure color. It is not what they call a primary color, like red or yellow. It's not even a secondary color, which is a color created when two colors meet, like purple. To get a really dark shade of brown, you have to mix all kinds of colors together. You have to create a real fine mess, like shit. That's brown. When I think of myself as brown, I think of myself not as this. This is orange. In a paint shop, I would be described as Aztec orange, suitable for patios. But brown happens the moment you have several colors colliding and mixing. The first brown moment in the Americas, the Indian sees the Dutch sailors from a distance. She takes the Dutch sailor into her eye, the brown moment, when from below deck comes Africa in chains, the sun enthralled to the moon, the African slave in chains. That moment that yellow meets red meets black is the first brown moment of America. What makes me brown in Latin America is that I am created from two races. I am created by the Spaniard and by the Indian. We still do not know, after all of these hundreds of years, we still do not know how to describe their meeting. Mexico calls it a rape. I have always suspected that it was also a seduction, that she wanted him. All that we know for certain is that one day the hairy Spaniard met the smooth Indian. He groaned, she moaned, And I cried. I had been alive for over 400 years. If you are brown, if you see yourself as brown in history, history offers you no easy consolation, because you cannot simply see yourself as the victim of history, because you are also the victimizer in history. I raped myself. I was the raped and the rapist. For African Americans to acknowledge that they are brown would be to acknowledge that they are not simply related to slaves, but they are related to slave owners. I am not simply related to the Indian. I am related to the conquistador who raped him. I despise Mexico. I will tell you that candidly. I despise Mexico. So many things about Mexico I despise. Mainly the way Mexico betrayed our parents. Its corruption, forcing our parents away. My father and mother's Sacramento, California. But Mexico is sexy in one crucial way that the United States is not. Mexico is sexy in that it understands that history often begins with an erotic moment. History often begins with desire, with sex, with sweaty bodies. Whereas I remember in Sacred Heart School, in Sacramento, California, where I grew up, my brown meant nothing. I remember at Sacred Heart School in Sacramento, California, about Thanksgiving time, we had this little drawing of the pilgrims to draw. And there came the pilgrims in black with straight lines for mouths. And they had invited the Indians for Thanksgiving dinner. And the Indians came with feathers and bells. And the Indians ate the turkey dinner that the pilgrims offered them and went back in the forest looking for Pepto-Bismol. And that was as sexy as American history ever got. Whereas in Latin America, everyone was falling in love with everyone. Everything was always melting. In the 17th century, the Indian in Mexico refused to do the work of the conquistador. Do it yourself. She grew lazy. It was too hot. She put aside the rake and the shovel and said, here, do it. So the Spaniard was forced to import African slaves into Mexico in the 17th century. That's not what I've come here to tell you today. It was the agreement of the church and the civil government in Mexico that the children of African-Indian marriage would be born free, which perhaps explained why he married her. But what did she see in him, the Indian in Mexico? What did she see in him? His beauty, his defiance, his energy. In the United States of America, every African-American friend of mine, every single one, over all the years of my life, has told me somewhere in the course of our friendship, by the way, they will say, every African-American has told me, did you know that I am part Cherokee? I'm part Sioux. I'm part Plains Indian. Which part, I say? Very funny, Michael says. And yet I said to Michael, and yet you called yourself black and you're an Indian. In Mexico, there was a name for children who were created by the Indian and the African. Because in Mexico, witty Mexico, seductive Mexico, sexy Mexico, Mexico noticed that the children of African Indian birth ended up looking Mongolian. The moment the African impregnated the Indian, he released from her Indian secret, her Asian secret, and the children looked Chinese. So that in the 17th century Mexico, the children of African-Indian marriage are called Chinos. We don't have a name in the United States. There is no name for Indian-African children in the United States. There are no names for many things. But I have come today to Santa Barbara, off the off the 101 freeway in bad traffic, I have come today to tell you that the world is round. And that ultimately, if we fall in love enough, we will all end up looking Chinese. Anyway, I was born in the 16th century, which is not bad. I used a lot of Botox for my wrinkles. But it was not until 1972 that I had a name for myself, that I was baptized. Richard Nixon was my godfather, and Pat Nixon was my godmother. She wore a green velvet dress. I remember a flower on her chest. I was a very big baby in her arms. It was in 1972 that Richard Nixon redefined the United States as an idea in several colors. Richard Nixon. He became my godfather, the dark father of Hispanicity. I think he was partly to undermine the Negro civil rights movement, which was turning north and becoming angry and was becoming the black civil rights movement. It was partly that. It was also that Americans suddenly had color TVs and the NBC peacock spread its wings and suddenly the Vietnam War was in lime green. But suddenly there was Richard Nixon in 1972 saying, you know, we are not only black and white, but we have color TVs. We are a Pentagon. We are also Asian / Pacific Islanders, yellow, American Indian / Eskimos, red, and coming in last but not least, ladies and gentlemen, the Hispanic. Forget for the moment that no one in Latin America has ever seen a Hispanic. You have to go to Dallas, Texas to see a Hispanic. But there it was in 1972, Richard Nixon naming me Soy Hispanic. This new book of mine began in maybe about 12 years ago. I was driving in Los Angeles on the San Diego freeway, yet another day on the freeway. And I was listening to NPR. Normally when I listen to NPR, I do it with both of my hands because you never know what you're going to hear on NPR. And on this day, the announcer on NPR was repeating a prediction by the U.S. Census Bureau, which was malicious and profane and anti-historical. The prediction, you've heard it many times since, the prediction of the U.S. Census Bureau was that Hispanics are destined to replace, that was the verb he used, to replace African Americans as America's largest minority. And I remember holding the wheels of my car looking for the Wilshire Boulevard and thinking to myself, in what way do I replace African Americans? How does my coming replace them? When they are responsible for my mouth, for my tongue, for this American tongue, their story is the center story of America. It teaches me what being an American means. In what sense do I replace them? Tell me, NPR. And how does comparing Hispanics, an ethnic group, to African Americans, a racial group, what does that mean? Apples and oranges? And what does it mean to become the nation's largest minority? Is that sort of an oxymoron? And the moment you become the nation's largest minority, are you therefore not a minority anymore? The radio didn't answer back. So I wrote this book instead. I call Brown the last discovery of America. The first discovery of America, 1492, the Indians see the Spaniards on the horizon, three ships, Columbus looking for an Indian restaurant. The most extraordinary thing about 1492, listen to it. Listen to it, you who are at universities. In 1492, the Indians saw the Spaniards on the horizon, and they didn't run away. They had never seen anything like those three galleons. They didn't run away. In what is one of the most sublime exercises of intellectual curiosity, the Indians came to the water's edge and waited for Columbus to approach. That first moment, we saw each other as other, as different, as separate. Brown, the last discovery of America, is the moment when I discover that you are already within me, that you are part of me, that I am African, that I am Chinese, that I am Irish. And who were those brown children in Monticello? We give Pulitzer Prizes to these dreary historians at Yale and Virginia who write histories of Thomas Jefferson, who write biographies of Thomas Jefferson, but they never bothered to tell us who those children were because America was always afraid of Brown. Even now, when every sort of sexual license is available to you at some far end of your TV dial, even now, we are like Puritans when it comes to Brown. And there we were at the Academy Awards this year. I always like to watch the Academy Awards when all these cutthroats get together in their Armani gowns and give each other humanitarian awards. There we were at the Academy Awards this year when Halle Berry won an Academy Award. And we still do not know how to say Brown. In anywhere in Latin America, she would be described as mulata. But in Hollywood, liberals insist that they have given an Academy Award to a black actress. I remember in the 1950s, a little boy named Buddy coming up to me in the schoolyard of Sacred Heart School and whispering in my ear a little malicious ditty that only a child can whisper to another while still smiling. And he said to me, "When you're white, you're all right. When you're black, stand back. When you're brown, stick around." So I stuck around. It was a kind of freedom in those years. Nobody seemed to notice. I wandered through Sacramento, no one seemed to notice. By the time I was 16 years old, Malcolm X was in town. I remember going at 16 to hear Malcolm X in Sacramento in a room. I did not know it was that he only spoke to black audiences. I walked in, I was brown, and nobody stopped me. I sat in a room this large, a room of black men listening to Malcolm X, his skin so much lighter in the light than mine. The next week, I went to see Joan Blondell in a play called The Pleasure of His Company with a lot of pink ladies. There were these traveling Broadway shows in Sacramento, they used to call them bus and truck shows. And I sat there with all the pink ladies, and no one said, "Why are you here, Brown?" I was free. I was irrelevant. But it was not until about 1970, there had been a riot in Chicago. Lyndon Johnson was president. And like good liberals, whenever there's a black riot in Chicago, it's the decision of the administration to form a committee and to find out why. Why? Why are blacks angry? Why did they throw a rock through the glass? Let's form a committee to find out why. And this committee was called the Kerner Commission, after Governor Kerner. And they came up with a prediction. I remember I was in high school at the time. They came up with the prediction that America was dividing into black and white. And something better be done about it, because one side of America was going to be black and the other side white. And by that time, I was 16 years old and I was angry because I wanted a place in this story. I was brown and I wanted a place in this story. And no one was talking in those years about brown. And even now, Colin Powell, God bless him, Colin Powell on page 9 of his autobiography tells us, "Yes, I am African American. I am also Caribbean Indian. I am also Scots-Irish. I am also Anglo-Saxon." And Barbara Walters says to him, "Well, that's nice, dear, but what does it feel like to be the first black Secretary of State. And even now, Tiger Woods tells us, you know, I cannot disown my mother. I am not black. I am African. I am Thai. I am also American Indian, there it is again. And I am white. But then came the elephants and the spices and the bells. I remember sometime in the 1950s, my Mexican Indian aunt married my uncle from India, from Bombay. His name was a song. His name was Krishna Chandra, a beautiful song. So of course, like good Americans, we shortened his name and called him Krish. I remember Christmas dinners in Sacramento, California in the 1950s. I remember the Mexicans and the Indians from India. I remember the turbans. I remember Ramesh used to come and stand on his head. We always hoped that he would do it before dinner. I remember Dr. Gupta, who was Krish's sister, who was not, my mother whispered to me one year, who was not a real doctor. She was a chiropractor. So much for multiculturalism in the 1950s. And I remember her singing these Hindu hymns over the turkey. Over the turkey. I remember in those years, my cousin, Delia, I remember one summer we were joking in Sacramento that we didn't have a name for her, that she was a stutter. She was an Indian. And already then, in the 1950s, I realized that we were entering a brown phase that had never been named in America. No one had names for the children who were being created in California. And now there are Blaxicans in LA, kids naming themselves because there are no adults to name them. And the other day after one of my speeches, I don't know where it was, a guy came up to me and said, I'm Jewish, my wife is Indian, from India. He said, the kids call themselves Hindus. And just yesterday in the Bay Area, I met a kid who calls himself a Negro Pino. I hadn't met a Negro Pino before, but there he was. Filipino, African, Negro Pino. And I remember a blonde lady, the blonde lady at Christmas. She looked like the Clairol lady in those years, probably too young to know what I'm speaking of. On the boxes of Clairol, there was a white lady, so white, she was like snow, and her hair was almost as white, but blonde. Ash blonde, I think they call it. And every Christmas she would come and she'd sit over there on the blue sofa, and she sat quietly with a coffee cup on her lap. And I asked my mother, I badgered my mother, who is she? Why is she here? I understood why the Hindus were here. I understood the turbans and the sombreros, but who was she? And my mother said, well, she married Krish's nephew. They met at Berkeley. They're lawyers. What do you want to know? No, well, why is she here? Why has her blondness invaded this room full of brown? And it was not until many years later that I realized that in fact her blondness was darkening our brownness, that she was making us even more brown. I remember so much from those years, my uncle now dead. I remember he was a dentist. I used to go with him to the farm worker communities in Yolo County, just on the other side of the river. There were three major Quonset hut villages, one for Mexican young men, in those years they called them braceros, men who worked with their arms. And then there was a camp for Filipinos, some of the most ancient old men whose skin had been blackened brown by the sun. And then there was a camp of Sikhs, these men with pink and red and yellow turbans. They used to sit on a kind of kitchen stool outside of this Quonset hut, and my uncle would pull teeth, and they would tip their turbans slightly, uncomplaining in the silence as he pulled her teeth. the mystery of that silence, their turbans like great roses about to unfurl. Nowadays, of course, the Sikh is married to the Filipina and has a Mexican uncle. Nowadays, I meet them all the time. I was in Atlanta, Georgia recently, and a young woman came out to me and said, "Do you know what I am?" And I said, "No, what are you?" She said, "I'm an African Korean." I said, "That's nice." She said, "That's not half of it." I thought, "Oh God, what comes next?" She says, "I'm a Baptist Buddhist." All this time, I had been trying to figure out what a Richard Gere Buddhist is, and now I have to deal with a Baptist Buddhist. "Does it have anything to do with gerbils?" I said. "Baptist Buddhist," she says. I told a theologian in Seattle, we were having a cup of brown coffee on a very gray day in Seattle. He was out of sorts. I said, "Oh, by the way, I've met a Baptist Buddhist in Atlanta. He said, "That's impossible." He said, "There's no such thing as Baptist Buddhism." I said, "But she walks." And then one morning, quite unexpectedly, because I had started writing about Brown some years ago, I got a letter from a young woman on starched white paper, stationery. She writes in the first sentence of her letter, she says, in her words, "I am the daughter of a New York Jew," her mother, "and an Iranian Muslim," her father. She is, in short, a Jewish Muslim. And then in her second sentence, she offers what is truly one of the great examples of brown humor. She says, "Most people think that I'm a very frugal terrorist," she says. I have come to celebrate her brownness, but after September 11th, there is also the necessity to say that there is something about a Jewish Muslim that should give us pause. For there is now in the world danger in brown. Consider, I am of a Saudi family, upper class. I was raised speaking several languages. My name is Osama bin Laden. Look at me. There is a picture of me in Vanity Fair at the age of 14. There I am with my brothers and sisters. We are standing in front of the Beau Rivage Hotel in Geneva. I spoke in those years fairly good French. But by the age of 16, Osama bin Laden does not want to be a cosmopolite, does not want to belong to the world, which is too brown. He wants his life to be a straight line. He does not want his life to be a curve. He wants to be one thing, not two things, not three things, not four things. And so he decides to live in a cave. He decides to live with people exactly like himself, only like himself, because the brown world, your world, is too complicated for him. And I think to myself, we could be entering a very dangerous brown time where brown children go to war against themselves. And who would have guessed it? Who would have guessed that at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado, that it would be the grandson of an observant Jew who would choose Hitler's birthday as the day to go into the cafeteria to shoot it up? Who would have guessed it? Two things are happening simultaneously in California. On the one hand, everything is melting. Everyone is marrying everything. The only state that has more racial intermarriage than we do is Hawaii, and that's because they don't wear any clothes. But in California, everything is marrying. Everyone is flirting, and we are consuming one another. I was doing a piece some years ago for a German magazine on skinheads. I've been very interested in the skinhead movement. I'm one of these people who was not surprised that the bomber in Oklahoma City turned out to be the boy next door. And I have said to liberal friends of mine, this regarding affirmative action, that it is a grievous mistake not to describe the white working class as minorities in this country. It is a grievous mistake to count them out. But there I was, doing a piece on skinheads, almost got my head blown off in Idaho, was saved at the last minute by the intervention of a woman who came between me and a group of guys who were in for some good times and wanted to play with me. Anyway, there I was interviewing an official from the KKK in El Cajon, California, for a German magazine, at a time when the largest skinhead movement in the world is in Spain. This was not a major wizard, this was a baby wizard. But there he was talking about Mexico, how we have to keep the line separating us from Mexico deep, lighted at night, put a fence up, a wall, police it every 10 feet, do whatever you need to do to keep them from us. And it came to be lunchtime, and I had all these Deutschmarks in my pocket. And I've been very well trained by my mother, take the skinhead out to lunch. I said, do you want to have a burger? Thinking skinheads eat beef. He said, actually, I like Mexican food. I said, are you crazy? Do you know what's going on in a burrito? A Spaniard is making love to an Indian in a burrito, and they are wrapped with tortilla. And that's what you're eating. And it's going into your mouth and down your throat. Big deal, he says. I like enchiladas. It is often the case, usually in springtime, for some reason in springtime, that I'm invited to high schools and colleges where it is usually Diversity Week, and I am Mr. Diversity. And the students look at me rather the way you look at me, wondering who the hell is this guy, and why do I have to sit through 50 minutes of this, and do I get extra credit? And the teacher, the headmaster at the school in LA, who has a British accent, but I think he's really from Australia, says to me, by the way, I can hear all the animals in the Colosseum as we're going down the hallway, waiting to devour me, I can hear them. The headmaster says, oh, by the way, he says with his British accent, the kids hate the word diversity. Now they tell me. It's the parents who love it. And you go in there and they stare at you, these kids who have had it up to here with diversity. And you go into high schools all across this country, and at a time when the entire world is enrolled at a high school in Virginia, the entire world, the kids manage to segregate themselves according to every sort of planning requirement. On over there are nerds, over here are heavy metal, over here are hip-hop, over here are Chinese, over here are Mexicans who are not sitting with Mexican-Americans. Over there are queers, over there are Mormons who sit under a tree. That's what they call themselves. They sit under an oak tree. Or Mormons who sit under a tree. Over there are some girls wearing green and blue hair. And I say, who are those? And they say, oh, that's just some girls. And over there are are goths. And I say, no, but who are they? What's the blue hair about? And the principal says, well, that's where the sluts sit. So, of course, I sit with them. At a time when we are melting into one another, when the skinhead is eating a burrito, we sit in separate cafeteria tables. At the University of Arizona, about 10 years ago, when I was selling my last book, trying to sell my last book in a world that doesn't read, in a world of MTV, when those kids go to the Taj Mahal and have fights with each other, even while India floats beyond them. There I was at the University of Arizona, and I had the 6:30 slot in Tucson to do my reading, and a lesbian poet was coming at 8 o'clock. So I get the Mexican Americans, God bless them. They had postponed their burritos to listen to Richard Rodriguez. I had 200 or so. There was a very petulant young man. I could tell he was not happy. I don't know why he came. Why bother me with his petulance? In the middle of my speech, he got up, made a lot of noise, goes up the hallway, and opens the door at the back of the auditorium, and there in the lobby is his room full of DuckTales. And I think to myself, why can't I get those? Why can't I have the lesbians? And why can't the lesbian poet get the Mexican Americans? Because it doesn't work that way. In a world that is brown, we are becoming more segregated, not less. So there I am, sitting on my bed at a 5-star hotel built by Texans in London called the Lanesborough Hotel, built to resemble an Edwardian hotel that never existed, except in the minds of fevered Americans. And I am waiting for my reviews for my last book. It has just been published in England. And staying in the hotel with me, just one floor below me, is Madonna, the Queen of Brown. Madonna, who has the freedom, who has the license, who has the savvy to be brown. One day Marilyn Monroe, the next day Dolores Del Rio, the next day a geisha. And outside my window, every time I come to my windows to close the drapes, there are these Brits with green and blue hair who begin the chant thinking that I'm her boyfriend at that time, who was a kind of gigolo toy boy that she picked up. Madonna, Madonna, they go. And I'm waiting for breakfast. And in comes the waiter, an Indian, speaking Hindu Cockney, with several London papers under his arm. And here I am, 10 years later, and I still hesitate to tell you that what makes me really, really brown in America right now, and the reason I think that I have written this book about brownness, is that my deepest secret is erotic. I am queer. I am gay. I'm a fag. I am waiting in London in a hotel room for reviews. And what the book editor of the London Observer has done is that he's gone throughout London on a Saturday morning looking for a fag who is brown to review my book. And he has found a Colombian gay to review a book by a Mexican gay, because who else would understand it? In a world in which everything is brown, find a rhyme for orange. Anyway, I grew up with this very, very interesting knowledge of myself, and I knew that the most dangerous thing I could tell you was that I was in love with you, the most dangerous thing. And even today, just yesterday, I was told by a radio announcer in this city that there had been a hate crime over the weekend. And I think to myself, what is that against the love crimes in America? Black men lynched in this country, lynched for the crime of looking at her, for the crime of glancing at her, lynched, love crimes. I remember when I was a boy, a boy named Tommy Crawford, who went on. You see, I didn't ruin his career. He went on to become a minor league baseball player and then disappeared. Wherever minor league baseball players go, there he is. Anyway, I remember one day we were playing in the backyard and I had a crush on him, and it was so intense that I was so frustrated. I was about 9 years old that I threw a hammer at him. He deflected it. Tommy was very fast. He deflected it with his shoulders. Anyway, I remember that night, our mother's talking on the phone, my mother saying to his mother something like, well, boys will be boys. Boys will fight with boys. But I knew even then that if I told her the truth, that if I told her that I wasn't fighting at all, that I had a crush on Tommy Crawford, the roof would have fallen down. I spent my adolescence looking for love where love did not belong. The blonde lady who was related to my Indian uncle, I remember stopping one day in an American history book to see a picture of an African-American sitting in an Irish bar. It must have been the 1890s in New York. Who is he? Why is he there? Always that sense that there was an erotic story in America. People were going places where they didn't belong. They were falling in love with people precisely because of difference. I'm going on too long. Let me just say in closing that I never expected you to become Canadians. All the things I thought you would become when you went to Santa Barbara, I never thought you'd become a Canadian. Surfer, yes. Feminist, yes. But a Canadian. There is this little virus in our water called Canadian multiculturalism, and it is now the official orthodoxy of most of our high schools and colleges. It was begun in Canada in 1972 under the administration of Prime Minister Elliott Trudeau. The idea is very Canadian indeed, that we will celebrate the fact of our diversity. Does this sound familiar? The fact that you are not I, let us celebrate that fact. Yay. And it is noble the way Canada is noble. Canada is respectful to all of her minorities, gay, Indian, Pakistani, Ukrainian. We will celebrate our diversity, damn it. Mexico doesn't know anything about multiculturalism. Mexico knows only mestizaje, sweaty bodies piled on sweaty bodies, screaming children. Mexico knows only the erotic principle. Isn't it curious about Canada, though, that there is no such thing as Canadian cooking? I mean, have you ever had a friend say, let's go to a Canadian restaurant tonight? What would they serve there, do you imagine? Water? Robin McNeil, the great son of Canada, and a good friend of mine, says, oh no, Richard, there is in New York on the Upper West Side, over by Lincoln Center, he says, there is a restaurant that serves Canadian food. It's called a Royal Mountie something or other. And I say, Robin, what do they serve there? And he says, pancakes, very big pancakes. Whereas in the classroom, we teach our children to be Canadians, celebrate diversity. In the schoolyard, our children are becoming Mexicans. The Filipina is flirting with the African. And they are hungry for heartburn. They want the burrito. Actually, I've engaged the bus, which is outside this auditorium, to take us to Whittier Avenue in LA to a burrito stand that serves probably the most perfect California cuisine imaginable, summarized at the top of their menu by the tofu burrito. The tofu burrito is almost platonic in its ideal form. It is the ideal form because you gain and you lose weight at the same time. And I think to myself now, there are things going on in this country, not only children naming themselves because the adults have no names for them, but music. Music may be carrying this brownness farther than my words can ever do. There was a woman in the New York Times just a few weeks ago, the New York Times, which is probably our last great black and white newspaper. Punjabi American, the New York Times describes her. She's a DJ in New York, Punjabi American. And she says, so much music plays through my body, the Punjabi music of my ancestors, the music of Bollywood in Bombay, hip-hop in New York, salsa in New York, the music flowing through my body, she says, brown. But it is 10 o'clock, and ding dong, the UPS man is there. And yesterday, I went out, and his hair was silver, silver, like a comic book hero, silver, not white. Not an old man's hair, silver, like a comic book hero. And today it's blue, and he has enormous brown thighs. Tomorrow it will be yellow like hay. And I think to myself, I remember Malcolm X, the last great Puritan, standing in light like this in Sacramento, California when I was 16, Malcolm X urging young African Americans away from skin lighteners and hair straighteners. And there he is, the UPS man with blue hair. And I think we are entering an era of play in America, of meltdown in America, of brown in America. Triumphant, dangerous. And my niece changes the colors of her eyes more often now than she changes her t-shirts. And today she has green eyes. It remains only for me to tell you about my Indian cousin. She married an American Indian, truly. So they had a son who was more than a stutter. He was an absolute stutter. He was an Indian. And he works now as a waiter in San Francisco, not far from where I live, on Presidio Avenue. Come, I will take you. And he serves lunch to the ladies who lunch in my yuppie neighborhood, serves them goat cheese salads. And there he is, 6 feet tall, the Indian. And all the women tell him that he looks Italian. Thank you very much.
I was wondering when you either refigured or noticed the change from of yourself as a brown person in a black and white world to saying, well, the world went from black and white to this muddy to this brown.
You were asking, when did that happen?
What kind of progression or...
What was the history of that from a world being black and white to suddenly this world of muddy brown? I think it was the Nixon years. And I think it was as I became, as people began to describe me as Hispanic, and as this, there was a sense that I had some identity here that was quite new. And then it was that I was growing up in California with Vietnamese and Thais and Filipinos, and that quite clearly there were things going on at family funerals of mine and family weddings, single families that came with several races of cousins and in-laws. I began to realize that something really significant was happening here. But it has been happening here for a very long time, in fact. It was Karl Marx, the old pappy of Marxism, who said about the California Gold Rush that it would prove to be a more significant event in world history than the discovery of gold by Columbus, but the discovery of the Americas by Columbus. That when America is discovered by Columbus, two races meet, the Indians meet the European. But when gold is discovered in California in the 1840s, the entire world comes together in one place. Filipinos, Australians, Peruvians, Mexicans, Chinese, Frenchmen, Englishmen, Australians, they all come together. I would like to say that it was a very nice time they had in the California gold fields, and it was all like that Coke advertisement where they all wear ethnic costumes and they all sing, I'd like to give the world a song. But in fact, one out of five men died in those gold fields. It was an enormously violent time. Most of those men ended up without great fortune. But Karl Marx said, mark my words, in the history of the world, something will have begun in California, in the California gold fields. A great civilization will have begun in a way that, unlike anything we've ever seen before, the entire world in a place. And I think now that he was referring to gridlock on the Santa Monica Freeway. Yes.
I enjoyed your talk very much. Would you care to comment on the current scandals in the Roman Catholic Church?
Yes. Well, one of the things, I mean, I do think it's a, I do think it's a, we are at a very crucial moment. One of the brownest things I say about myself is that I'm a gay Catholic. And my gringo friends say, well, how can you say that about yourself? And what, how can you belong to a church that that demeans you as much as the Catholic Church does, as demeans your homosexuality? And I say, well, but I was shaped by Catholicism. It formed my mouth, it formed my hands, it formed my soul. It is so deep in me, I cannot move myself away from it. And on the other hand, my Catholic friends say, well, how can you be gay? It's not, it's just a lifestyle. How can you give yourself to that? And I say, but you don't understand. I am homosexual. This is who I am. Homosexuality has formed my mouth, formed my soul. I am both. I am brown. There was nothing, there was no suggestion in all the years I was raised as a boy of the scandal that we are seeing now. Nothing like it. Though I have known for some time a very strong homosexual population within church clergy, I do not regard pederasty as homosexual, nor do I regard rape as heterosexual. These seem to me perversions within sexual experience, because they are about power. They are about my power over you, and particularly the adult over the child seems to be the most reprehensible form of power. But any more reprehensible than the man, the brutish man's power over the woman? No. But in an odd way, what I am hearing people, Catholic friends of mine, say right now is that as hideous and as pathetic as this priestly behavior was, the anger in the church right now is reserved for the hierarchy and for its mishandling of this entire affair. And in an odd way, one mimics the other, because all of what we are beginning to see in this revolution that I'm beginning to feel forming in the Catholic laity against the hierarchy is something like a Protestant Reformation. We demand a right in deciding who will govern us, who will be our leaders. We may all end up Catholic Presbyterians, which would be a nice thing to be. But for the time being, I am struck by the fact that there is this holding on to power and this misuse of power by very powerful men who are used to dealing with the congregation as children. And in a very odd way, the behavior of these pederast priests mimics their behavior, because it is all also about power, about exerting my will over your will. And I think it's a very serious moment in the church. But I also think, like all great moments, that this is a very creative possibility. There are great creative possibilities at this moment. I'm not at all depressed. I must tell you, I mean, the great figures in my life within the clergy were the nuns, not the priests, and particularly 8 members of an order called the Sisters of Mercy, and an Irish order, remarkable women, who were honored on a monument on the north side of the state capitol. These were formidable women who came to Sacramento and built hospitals and schools, orphanages, tended men in the gold rush who in the smallpox epidemics. These women were so thoroughly, powerfully feminists that they created this man who stands in front of you. They forced Elizabeth's language, Queen Elizabeth's language, down my throat. Who else would do that with such bravery but the Irish? Because they wanted me finally to bite back. They wanted me to take this language and to bite back. So there I was in Idaho just last week, Iowa, but too late by 2 weeks. Iowa has just declared itself safe for the English language. Iowa has declared English the official language of Iowa. And I think to myself, has no one told them in Iowa what the British have been trying to tell us in the United States for over 150 years, and that is that we do not speak English.